Welcome to episode 173 of the Sentientism Podcast, a podcast about what's real, who matters, and how we can make a better world. The Sentientism worldview answers those deep questions by committing to using evidence and reason and having compassion for all sentient beings. In this episode, I speak with Jane Kotsman. Jane is an Alfred Deakin Postdoctoral Research Fellow at Deakin Law School. She has degrees in commerce and law, a PhD in human rights law, and a postgraduate diploma in teaching. Jane has published research on human rights, and animal law. She's taught a range of courses, including human rights law, administrative law, and contract law. She was a finalist for Academic of the Year in the Australian Law Awards in both 2019 and 2020, and her article titled "Recognising the Sentience of Animals in Law, a Justification and Framework for Australian States and Territories" was given an Australian Legal Research Award in 2022 for Best Early Career Research Article. Before her career in academia, Jane was an associate in the Teach for Australia program. And before that, she was in private legal practice for a number of years, principally in commercial litigation. I'd love to know what you think of this episode and the 172 others in our somewhat timeless back catalogue. Why not let me know via a review or rating? Reviews, ratings, and sharing help more people find out about the sentientism worldview, hopefully nudging the world towards more compassionate, rational thinking. You can find out more about sentientism at sentientism.info, where you can sign up for email updates, or just search for sentientism on your favourite social media platform. You'll be made very welcome in all of our global online communities. They're open to anyone interested, not just sentientists. Thanks for listening. Good evening, Jane. How are you?
Good, Jamie. How are you?
Yeah, really good, really good. Well, thank you so much for taking the time to be my guest on the Sentientism podcast and YouTube. And I was led to it partly by seeing one of your talks online based around a paper you did called Sentience and Intrinsic Worth as Pluralist Foundation for Fundamental Animal Rights. And it sort of ticked so many boxes with respect to this sort of sentientism idea. I thought it would be wonderful to have the chance to talk to you about that, but your wider worldview too. So it's great to have you here. And we have a few connections already, some through Deakin, because my guest in episode 106 was Adam Cardellini, and one of my very recent episodes with Yamini Narayanan in episode 160. And I think you also, as I was researching you at one point, co-wrote an article with Nick Pendergrast.
Yeah, we have quite a good critical animal studies network at Deakin.
Yeah, it's really impressive. And that's one of the things we might come back to later. It feels like it's, you know, on the forefront of making this topic much more mainstream, as opposed to being a sort of a niche hidden away on the side. It's becoming a core area of many fields of academia too.
Yeah, no, absolutely.
You know this already, but this is a series of conversations about what I think of as the most fundamental and most important philosophical questions. And I keep banging on at them because I think most humans still get them wrong. So I'm going to keep going until I've persuaded everybody. And those questions, I guess, are, you know, what's real? How should we understand reality? The questions of epistemology and the questions of what matters, but just as importantly, who gets to matter in our ethical considerations? And I have an obvious bias because I'm trying to develop and popularize this very simplistic, pluralistic worldview that I'm calling sentientism, partly through co-opting a word that already existed. It's been around since the 1970s, but in simple terms, it's evidence, reason, and compassion for all sentient beings. But so when it comes to the what's real and how should we understand that question, it says, well, we should use evidence and reason to try and understand reality with hopefully a healthy dose of humility, always open to learning and new evidence and better reasoning. And then the question of who matters, the clue is in the name. It suggests that we should have compassion for all sentient beings, every sentient being, any being that has the capacity to experience things, suffering, flourishing, anything, that should warrant serious moral consideration. But I'm talking to people in these conversations, you know, some agree and some disagree with that broad worldview. So it'll be great to understand how your thinking fits in if it does. But before we get on to those big questions, how would you best introduce yourself and your work for people who don't know you?
So my name, obviously, is Jane Kotsman. I am a research fellow at Deakin University, previously senior lecturer. So next year I'll go back to lecturing again, but I've had the benefit of a couple of years of research only, which has been really nice. Give me an opportunity, actually, to focus specifically on sentience and the statutory, specifically the statutory interpretation implications of sentience recognition. So I suppose fundamentally I'm an academic. In my past, I was a lawyer. I didn't really like that very much. Following that, I went into teaching in high schools, which was actually really enjoyable, but I found exhausting, just in terms of, I suppose, in some ways to teach, you know, kind of in that really intensive 6, 7, 8 hours a day, it takes a lot out of you. And I missed the kind of opportunity for introspection and reflection that research gives you. So now I have the best of both worlds. I get to teach and I get to research. So I guess, you know, fundamentally that's me. My work, I should say, my research work centers on animal law. So I'm a lawyer by trade. My research is in the area of law, and specifically I focus primarily on animals. I have a background in human rights, though, so my PhD was in the area of human rights and specifically the right to education. So to animal rights, I often think about concepts that exist within human rights literature and think about how they might apply or be adapted to the animal rights space.
Brilliant. Thank you. Well, that's queued up many of the topics I think we're going to go on to talk about. So let's start with the first of these crazily broad philosophical questions, a question of what's real or how should we go about understanding reality? So for many of my guests, that's a story about whether they grew up originally in maybe a more religious or spiritual or sort of mystical context, family and society, or one that was more naturalistically focused, maybe more scientifically minded, or a mix of both, and how that side of their thinking has changed over time. So yeah, you can wind the clock as far as you like to sort of tell the story and explain how you think about this stuff now, the sort of big questions of what really is the universe and how should we understand it?
It's a really interesting question. And I had to think for a while when I first saw the question in previous podcasts, but I suppose for me, I grew up with parents that, so one of my parents is Catholic and one is Anglican, but both not necessarily what you call practicing, but because their families were Anglican and Catholic, there was some tension there between the two families. I went to church until I was 5 and we moved states away from my grandparents, and then I didn't have to go to church anymore. But then actually I ended up when I was roughly 15, went to a Lutheran school. And I suppose I was lacking in some self-confidence and issues like that. So the kind of religious angle not necessarily spoke to me, but allowed me a way to feel like I could try and connect to something. And I tried really, really hard, I have to say. So I became quite active in the Lutheran community, but I always struggled, to be honest, with trying to make myself believe something that, you know, for all intents and purposes, doesn't have a great deal of evidence in terms of the scientific evidence. So I wouldn't say I've left behind the idea of, you know, there being something other than the world. I think there is something other than, you know, what we can see, touch, smell, feel and taste. But I'm not going to commit to knowing what that is. So I guess that's where I come to now is a feeling that at least what we see, touch, know, feel, etc., humans can generally agree on those things. And I think there is value in those things. Beyond that, there may be more, I don't know. So I think we need to have a space to allow people to believe things, but also to allow them to choose not to. Yeah, so that's kind of broadly where I sit these days.
Yeah, thank you. So it feels like, I would suggest you have a broadly naturalistic worldview in the way you think about reality, using evidence and reason to understand the stuff we can understand. But at the same time, there's an open-mindedness that may be something beyond what we can engage with in that on that basis that could still be real. But because we almost by definition don't have sort of a body of evidence about that, you hold back from having an opinion about what its nature might be, you know?
Yeah, I think I, at least personally, I find it hard to believe in something that, I mean, what would it be that I would believe in? I would have to construct that. And if I've constructed that in my mind, how do I know that that's real or not real? I mean, perhaps for other people that's different. But I guess, yeah, for me, certainly I think there's possibility that there's more. I think it's probably likely that there's more, but I just don't know what it is.
And I like that approach because in a sense it's having even a radical open-mindedness, I think, is part of having a good scientific and naturalistic worldview. I think we've made a wrong turn if we're like, no, I'm 100% sure this is it, and I've done the experiments and we have the answer and I'm going to turn my brain off. I think having that sort of open-mindedness to even deeply weird stuff or very strange stuff or very alien stuff or things we don't currently understand is healthy, partly because a lot of the stuff that science has understood as well-founded now is deeply weird stuff, right? If you get into quantum mechanics and, you know, some of the other things the physicists are doing, I mean, it just totally crushes against our intuitions, which were evolved for a very different purpose, right? So we should be open-minded about weird stuff. But the reason I like it is because you're then refusing to take that next step and make stuff up about the nature of what these other things might be. And I think that's where things can turn into a difficult space, and partly why I prefer a naturalistic world, is because I think it's good to be open-minded about the possibility of stuff beyond the natural world. I think that's entirely fair. But when people start to believe quite concrete things about that, one, we can't really engage with that meaningfully because it's not based on a body of evidence in the first place. So it's quite hard to engage with a belief that in a sense is arbitrary. And that might not be harmful. It might just be a fun thing to believe in or an interesting thing to believe in. It might even be beneficial because people might feel it gives them meaning or might have some positive aspects in their lives. But quite often it can spin into warping ethics or exclusionary ethics or causing problems or causing harm or turning people to patterns of behavior that even harm themselves. And if we can't engage with those beliefs on the basis of evidence, it's very hard for us to resist or help or plug in some sense, because, you know, they found a completely alternative mooring for their belief that we can't realistically engage in. So, yeah, so there's risks in there, but I think my sense is just being open-minded doesn't fall foul of those risks because you're just open-minded and, you know, have this sense that there might be more, but you're not holding to beliefs about that.
Yeah, no, I wouldn't hold to beliefs about that. But I mean, I understand that other people do and have done for a very long time, and that can be, you know, some very intelligent people I know are deeply religious. I guess, you know, I have no problem with that, except where they decide that allows them to hurt others. And that's where I draw the line.
Absolutely. Yeah, I'm with you. And we often focus on the topic of religion here just because culturally that's such an obvious choice, is religion or non-religion or spiritual but not religious or atheist or agnostic. But of course, that's not the only question when it comes to epistemology. There are all sorts of other worlds or domains where believing things that aren't well grounded in evidence can cause harm too. So yeah, it's not just a religious question. It's a question of, you know, almost any situation where just understanding reality wrong can lead even good people to do bad things sometimes. So it's a much broader question than that. So thank you. That's been really interesting to explore as a sort of basis for your epistemology and how you think about the universe. So should we come on to the ethical questions now? So this is quite interesting for people who started out with a more formalized religious worldview. So as you said, you know, there was Catholic, there was Anglican, there was Lutheran, partly because those religious worldviews come with some, you know, statements of fact about gods and heaven and hell and various other things that you need to believe. But they also come with a sort of with an ethical toolkit too. You know, there's the Bible and or the Quran, or there's norms that you need to comply with as well. So it comes as part of the package. And when someone moves away from a religious worldview, either like me to just become a sort of boring old atheist, or they become spiritual but not religious, or in your sense, you know, you still have a sense that there is more, but you don't necessarily sign up to this sort of institutional religion in quite the same way. There's quite an interesting question there about, if we've moved away from that foundation of our ethics and morality, what should our morality and ethics be based on? What do good and bad and right and wrong even mean? So again, that would be interesting to understand your story about when you were growing up in the context of those religious worldviews, how did they shape how you think about ethics and morality? And how have you come to think about it now? What do good and bad and right and wrong mean for you?
Yeah, that's another really big question as well. Now, this podcast, big question. In fact, I don't know that, well, at least my parents' religions, I don't know that they had a huge impact on me, to be honest, probably because my parents weren't practicing themselves. the Lutheran thing did. And by and large, I mean, I found the Lutheran community to be really big-hearted and generous and empathetic and wonderful people. But of course, in religions, you sometimes come across people that interpret things in certain ways. And I'm not sure where the Lutheran community is at today, but I remember on camps that I went on, I took great pleasure, actually, I probably shouldn't have, in, you know, debating the alleged sins of homosexuality with some of the pastors. And so, you know, even from that time, I always found issues in kind of these rigid rules that didn't really make a lot of sense to me in the world that I could see. I think my moral code, or however you want to term it, was probably primarily driven, or at least encouraged, through reading. I read a truckload when I was growing up. My grandfather used to say, get your nose out of that book or it'll get stuck in it.
And what sort of stuff were you reading?
Fiction, just lots and lots of fiction. And I think, you know, that it's through fiction you develop a strong sense of empathy, and I think that's, you know, that's kind of what drove me then and drives me today. You know, when I was 12, my family were living in India, and I became vegetarian at that point. Didn't make my parents very happy, but I don't know. I was always just very certain with that. And then, I mean, veganism back then was absolutely radical. It's not something that I probably entertained until I became pregnant. And then, you know, I really looked into, you know, not just the ethics of consuming animal products, but also the impact on your health, the impact on the environment, all these kind of interconnected issues, and made a decision, you know, for, you know, my children's health as well, which I guess sometimes we make decisions on the basis of our own health or other people's health, and sometimes I think it's just fitting in and probably, you know, waiting to embrace veganism for that length of time. So it's a good 20 years between deciding to be vegetarian, deciding to be vegan. It was probably, to be honest, just a matter of fitting in and then life being easy, because even now life as a vegan is a lot easier than it would have been 20 years ago, but it's still not necessarily easy.
And to pick out one word from that, I think empathy feels like it was maybe the core, right? So your reading of fiction helped develop that, and that's maybe been the core that's run through since. But if I can drag you back to the Lutheran ethics, I'm interested in what you thought the core was there, because for some people, and I will oversimplify this massively, right? For some people, it is the list of rules, right? And whether it's the Ten Commandments, but it's often more than that, right? It's, to be cynical about it, often it feels like it's a sort of package of medieval social norms imported into the modern day, right? So for some people, it really is. It's like, here is the list of rules, and that is the foundation. For other people, it is really about obedience. You know, the reason we need to be good is because God demands it, and ultimately, you know, we'll get punished if we're not good, and we'll get rewarded in heaven if we are good. So it's really, you know, people call it a divine command theory, right? That's why good and bad are good and bad, is because God says, right? And that's the answer. I think it's also it's actually very common, even in quite a strict religious context, it really is empathy and compassion that drives most of those people. And you said, you know, many of the people in that community, you got that sense from them, right? It was in a weird way, even though they're religious people and they would probably point at a religion as their ethical framework, actually the core was empathy, compassion, caring for others, even love for others. And that's the core. Well, did you have a sense in that Lutheran community as to the sort of mix of those things, or was it something else that was, you know, why should we be good people? What's the root?
That's a really good question, and I probably haven't really thought about it quite in those terms before, because actually when we came back from India, I went to first a Catholic school, and I hated that Catholic school. I was there for about a year and a half, I think, And I hated it because I felt lost. You know, there were so many students and, yeah, I just didn't feel seen, I suppose. Whereas when I went to the Lutheran school, you know, it was just so much more nurturing and they took great effort to see the individual and to, you know, some private religious schools will really push students to get very high grades here. This school wasn't like that. The very strong focus was on understanding the individual and assisting the individual to, you know, to be the best version of the person that they could be or that they should, you know, that people, you know, that kind of religious terminology, God gives people gifts and, you know, your job is to kind of fulfill or use those gifts to assist others. So, I guess the strong feeling I had from that community was that, you know, that it really revolved around empathy and compassion and a really nurturing approach to teaching and mentoring children and teenagers. I mean, is for example, my best friend I met at that school, and her father is a pastor. He just passed away a few months ago, but even though he's a Lutheran pastor, and my husband is very much an atheist, and I'm not practicing anything, he was very happy to come and marry us, you know, because it's about the values rather than about, you know, the rules and adherence to particular doctrines and so forth. So, yeah, I mean, that's definitely the impression I got from that community.
Yeah, thank you. And I think it's an important distinction because, in a sense, if your ethics is grounded in because God says so and the existence of a heaven and a hell, if that is the foundation, or if the foundation is the religious rules in a book, that can lead some people to quite an existential crisis when they leave a religion because if they're like, okay, I've come to the realization this isn't true anymore. Those things have crumbled, they've disappeared, and they need to rebuild their ethics. But I think many people actually have quite a much easier journey away from a formal religious worldview because actually their ethics is grounded in empathy and compassion. And to be empathic and compassionate, you never needed the religion or the priests or the God or the heaven and hell in the first place because just cared about other people. And now you still do, right? So I think that's often a much easier transition to have a religious worldview for people who, to be honest, their ethics were never dependent on the stuff in the religion anyway. They were just good people trying to live a good life.
Right? In some cases, you know, the religion just provides you with a sense of connection to a community that, particularly in contemporary times, it's hard to have that sense of connection to community. So it can be useful in that way, but that doesn't necessarily mean the entire construct is true.
Yeah, exactly. And as you said, when they start condemning homosexuality as a sin or threatening children with burning in hell for eternity if they break the rules, or, you know, women can't be priests, or, you know, and the list goes on, right, with different varieties and different worldviews, that's where the problems start to come through. But that doesn't mean we should, you know, throw the baby out with the bathwater, because as you said, that value of connection and community and coming together and often the really strong empathic ethical grounding is deeply important too. And I personally think you could do that without any of the supernatural beliefs, but, you know, most people around the world disagree.
Yeah.
So that's been fascinating. Thanks. And I think we'll come back to this idea about, you know, what matters is what the core of your ethics is about, and empathy and just caring for others. To my mind, that's almost self-evident. It's almost tautological, and it's almost in the definition of the word morality, right? Is if morality isn't about whether and how we care about others, what even is it? And if you have a moral or an ethical system that doesn't care about others, well, then I'd say that's just amoral, right? That's just not moral. So it feels like a pretty solid core. Just it's about some degree of caring about how things are going for others. But the second part of this ethical question is another massive social and cultural challenge. You've hinted at your journey through this already, which is the question of who matters. Because I think most people around the world, with whatever their world view would say, look, yes, empathy is generally a good thing and we should care about others. The critical question is, who are those others? So even within the human species, we have that problem where there are many humans who only care about an in-group of humans and not out-groups of humans, and we know where that leads and the pain that causes. But most humans, when they're thinking about others, intuitively, generally only think about other humans, right? And that question about whether and how we go beyond. Human moral consideration is deeply important and socially challenging too, even though most humans actually already break through that boundary, at least when it comes to selected companion animals or wild animals, so on. So we're a weird species. But again, I'm really interested in your journey there about that question about who matters and who warrants your empathy and who do you feel empathy for. How early did that start and how did that develop? And again, was fiction part of that journey as well?
I think it must have been. I mean, it's the only thing. It's a strong feeling I've just always had that, you know, we should care about others. And I mean, I remember when I was very young, I'd lie in bed and unable to sleep because I was so worried, knowing that my grandma would die one day and I didn't want her to die. And then I would try and imagine what dying would be and where would she be and what did that mean? And, you know, so these kind of existential questions kept me up. Even when I was very, very young, I'm not sure. I mean, fiction is about the only thing I can pin it on, perhaps, other than just sort of a personality. I don't know.
Yeah, it's very early to have an existential crisis.
Yeah. I was really, I mean, it's still, to be honest, it's still, I heard from psychologists, it is a real thing, you know, this kind of fear of death and not just fear of death, but, you know, like kind of panic reaction, fear of death is a thing.
There's a field called terror management theory, I think, where I think some of the theorists actually think that sort of awareness of our own mortality and that ultimate fear of death and our non-existence is actually a really deep psychological driver of lots of different human behaviors. So,
I had those feelings very, very young. You know, as I said, I became vegetarian when I was 12 and I stuck with that, which is interesting, from the age of 12.
And what was the thought process of going vegetarian? When did you first start to think? Because there's an easy step, right, which almost everyone takes, which is I care about non-human animals, right, to some degree, because you might have a companion animal at home or you might see animals free ranging. That's an easy step to say, well, I care about them in the same way as I might care about other humans. Connecting that to the food on your plate, that's the difficult step that very few people take. How did that pattern work for you? How were you making those connections at that age?
It was just obvious to me.
Yeah.
It sounds really condescending, though, doesn't it? Maybe there was some aspect of living in India that made it more obvious, but I don't know what that would be.
Do you remember seeing, because I mean, one of the things from my time in India and interviewing people who live there is, you know, animal agriculture is more transparent because it's, you know, it's not massively concentrated in industrial operations. It is the sort of thing that you may well see on the street and much more of the community you're actively involved in. So, you know, it's quite common to see slaughter in the open, right? It's not behind closed doors all the time.
I mean, it's possible. I don't have memories of that, but I mean, we had a cook as expats do over there, and she would serve up, you know, what she was, Western food, which is, you know, meat and three veg was the traditional thing back then. And I just didn't want to eat it. And so I said, no. And then that turned into a fight with my father. And I said, well, I'm going to eat it tonight. And so...
What was his pushback? And how did you continue anyway? Because that's hard at that age.
I don't know what his pushback was then. I mean, obviously, you know, you want to raise your children. I guess probably back then the likelihood is people believed that you needed to have meat and vegetables in order to be healthy. I imagine that was probably the belief. And you want your children to be healthy. It's obviously easier if children will all eat the same things. I've got two children and it's really very difficult to make them eat things.
Yeah. Even now, ours are 19 and 17, and it's still a challenge.
Oh, really? Yeah, pretty much. There's nothing that they'll both eat. I mean, even today, my father's very, like, when we talk about these issues, he'll say, well, I want to eat meat. And that's kind of nearly the end of the story. So I wouldn't expect a lot of discussion, but, you know, there's a very stubborn component to my personality as well. And it probably, in fact, I know it gave me great joy to say, no, I'm not going to eat now. And actually, now I never will again. Thank you. And I think he didn't believe me. Actually, now I'm getting some memories back. Yeah. And so, you know, I'm also a person that if you tell me I can't do something, I will do it.
Maybe that's a new form of activism we need to invest more in. Yeah,
yeah, exactly, right. I bet you can't sit with this.
Yeah, yeah.
So, you know, that's a little bit juvenile as a background. But then I remember in kind of my higher teenage years studying the Holocaust and just being absolutely fascinated is a horrible word in that context, you know, but I was just really drawn by the suffering that you could see in photographs in particular, and trying to comprehend how people could inflict that on other people and not, you know, feel the horror and so forth that I would feel. That was a huge, I suppose, influence for me. So I studied World War One and World War Two at university. Is there a scheme you can do that while you're still in high school? And I suppose that provided kind of the grounding to my interest in human rights when I came to study law. You know, when I was studying law, animal law was not a thing, right? That just wasn't a subject. I mean, actually, even when I spoke to my dean many years ago and talked about animal law, the question was, what is that? So even now, you know, people will say, well, what does that mean exactly? But certainly, you know, when I was saying, well, it was definitely not a thing. So it was not something that really I thought about. But then when I was doing my research for my PhD, that kind of led me to some of the animal law literature that is out there. And for me, that was kind of was an obvious switch, because human rights are violated all the time, right? All over the place, horrendous human rights violations, just like the Holocaust, awful. I guess the difference to me was, well, at least as a human, humans as a species, we can agree that this shouldn't happen. And we've agreed that, and we've said that these other things should happen. And even though they don't, we've kind of agreed that that's the normative should.
At least we put the stake in the ground and as an aspiration.
Yeah, we've got some ambition there.
Yeah.
But in the context of animals, that's just totally lacking. That most people think that it's acceptable to treat animals in the way that we do, I just find astounding. I mean, I often struggle to think of why that is the case. There's probably multiple reasons.
Less than 1% of humans are psychopaths, right? So it can't be that.
No.
And that's where the fascination comes, right? Most people in some sense are good, decent people who do at least want to try and make the world a better place, right? So how can these things happen? How can these things happen?
Yeah. That's right. So how can you get not just majority, but, you know, nearly universal support, really, for systems that impose such cruelty? I mean, I think a large part of it can be explained by reference to simple ignorance. But it's not just that. It's more than ignorance. So, yeah, I guess, you know, that's why we're in this space.
Yeah, thank you. And it would be good to dig into those as we come into our final question of, you know, how can we make a better future? But before we get there, I'd like to round out this who matters question, because it's clear your empathy extended to non-human animals, extended to non-human animals that were farmed. Hence, you decided, to go vegetarian and vegan to sort of boycott those systems and those industries because of your objection to them. But it'd be good, given some of your work, to zero in on slightly more technically, okay, so what is the boundary of moral consideration? Because I think most people come to this topic and think, well, it's about humans, right? So there's this sense of, you know, species solidarity, universal human rights. We're all humans, so we all matter. And in a way, that's the grounding for worldviews like humanism, and it's driven the human rights initiatives. And many people feel that today and would sign up to it. They come to the animal question through the term animal. Really. They said, well, you know, non-human animals matter as well, and therefore we should include them in our scope of moral consideration. How do you think more technically about the boundary of moral consideration, if there is such a thing? And because there are still quite a few different options we might choose, there are, you know, ecocentrists who will go all the way to saying, you know, almost everything matters in the sense because we're all interconnected. So rocks and rivers and trees and mountains and ecosystems and the Earth as Gaia ultimately all matter intrinsically, even if they're not sentient, they still matter intrinsically. There's a biocentrism which says all living things matter, again, intrinsically, even if they're not sentient. So, you know, for example, based on current scientific consensus, anyway, plants and fungi and trees intrinsically matter, even if no sentience exists. That's a sort of biocentric, all living things matter. My favorite, obviously, is sentiocentrism, which says, look, let's focus on sentience. And I don't mind if people want to go further, but I want to make sure that every sentient being warrants serious moral consideration as a baseline. But even around there, you can focus on sentience, you can focus on animals as a taxonomy, you can focus on personhood, you can focus on agency, you can focus on dignity, you can, you know, there's a sort of grab bag of different things that people will zero in on when they're saying, where should that scope extend to? How do you think about that question of ultimately who gets to matter in our moral consideration?
Yeah, look, it's a hard question, and obviously I'm not going to pretend that I can give you the answer. But from my point of view, I think the answer is twofold. Firstly, I would say that, you know, the most inclusive category you named there, your first one, is one I would agree with. So I think all natural living things matter. The trees matter, the rocks matter, they all matter. But they're also different in nature, and they don't just matter individually, I should clarify. You know, so the fact that there is an ecosystem matters, the fact that there are relationships between some of those beings matters as well. But as I just mentioned, those things are not all the same. So a rock is not the same as my dog. The rock is not aware of being a rock, as far as I know, whereas my dog, I'm quite sure, is very aware of being himself, painfully so. My dog is a wire runner. He has an anxiety disorder, and it's a long story.
Say hello from me. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. It's probably sitting outside the door because he's worried where I am.
Guest appearances are welcome, by the way, by non-humans. So if they need to come and join you, then they're very welcome.
Yeah. So I think, you know, there is difference between the natural features of the world, and treating natural beings with respect means different things in different contexts. So I guess you know, to come back to what you were saying, sentience, I think, is a relevant moral characteristic in that if you are sentient, you do have that kind of subjective view of yourself as being an independent actor and being capable of feelings, including pain and suffering and joy and so forth. And if a being has that capacity, then I think we need to treat that individual as being important, as opposed to, for example, you know, all the trees I think are intrinsically important, but is it going to matter if you know, one of them gets chopped down? Will I cry for that one tree? I'm not so sure. But would I cry for that one dog? Yeah, I think, you know, that's there's a kind of difference there.
Because the dog has a perspective. Things can go well or badly for them. They have interests, they have needs, they can feel. Yeah.
Whereas the tree, to the best of our scientific knowledge, doesn't have that at this point. At least we don't, you know, our understanding is that that doesn't exist in the case of the tree.
I have a frustration with many people who claim any sort of ecocentric view, and you might argue this is the central gravity of the modern environment, because they've sort of jumped from an anthropocentric humans matter to, oh, now the Earth as Gaia matters. So they're claiming a very broad, generous ecocentric concern. But actually, when you scratch under the surface of it, it's clear that really it's just a veneer on good old-fashioned anthropocentrism, because the reason they care about the Earth as Gaia is because, you know, frankly, it's pretty, you know, it's aesthetically appealing to us humans. Two, we need ecosystem services from it, and we need a comfortable temperature range, and we need, you know, it to provide us the food we need. And that's basically it, right? It's not really a moral concern intrinsically for the ecosystem. It's just another version of anthropocentrism. But the narrative is often that generous sense of, you know, everything matters and we're all interconnected. But where it quite often leads is, you know, the entire ecosystem matters, everything is interconnected, us humans should not have the hubris to stand apart from nature. We need to play our part in these networks of interdependent ecosystems. As part of nature and as part of ecosystem operation, life consumes life. So I'm going to have a cheeseburger and a milkshake. And again, yeah, but and I'm sort of joking, right? But in a way, that is part of the story, right? It's the circle of life, right? That you might hear from the sort of anti-vegan troll on Twitter is actually in a sort of slightly softer way, echoed by someone saying, "Well, we're all just part of nature, and things happen." So anyway, I'll put that caricature to one side. But that's one of my frustrations. Whereas your stance genuinely does have an ecocentric view, but at the same time, you recognize the distinctive moral salience of sentience and being a sentient being, and therefore having interests and needs that matter in a distinctive way from a rock or a tree or a river. And that's why I really appreciate that view, because it makes it very clear that you might go beyond sentiocentrism, but sentience still remains deeply important, such that you see the difference between pushing a knife into a pig and pushing a knife into a carrot. Right? These are radically different moral acts. So
they are. You know, otherwise we would. You know, how can you couldn't eat? I mean, well, I guess you could. I don't know, eat the fruit that falls from the tree or some such, but. Just touching on one of the things you just said around, this kind of the big view of, well, everything matters and it's all interconnected. And, you know, that can sound really exaggerated and fluffy, right? But, and that's why I find it really hard to explain, because I do think everything matters. My PhD student actually thinks nature doesn't matter. Nature is intrinsically not valuable. And in fact, I think she's at one point told me that nature is a failed state. And so she's, I welcome that kind of thinking, because it makes you try and defend what you yourself think if it's not the same thing, right? And I think it's a really hard thing to defend, because when you're talking about intrinsic worth, I mean, it's not really something that's grounded in anything at all. it's kind of that knee-jerk reaction for what is valuable and what is not. And I think you can make a good claim for why sentience is intrinsically valuable. It's probably harder to make the argument for nature, but I do think that it is. You know, my willingness to say nature is intrinsically valuable, I think, ties into that willingness to say, well, I don't know everything that's actually out there. I don't know the scheme that sits around, you know, the earth and its inhabitants. And perhaps there's something there that I don't understand. In fact, I'm quite sure there's things there that I don't understand. I know, for example, other animals can hear and see and smell things that I can't. So there's definitely stuff there that I don't know. I guess I just try and leave my mind open to whatever that might be without trying to make it up.
Yeah, makes sense. Thank you. And I do find this stuff fascinating, because in a sort of totally cosmic sense, it's true to sort of say nothing matters in that sense, right? Ultimately, we're all quarks buzzing around or vectors in some multidimensional Hilbert space. You know, we're just the operation of physics. And in a way, that's where my naturalistic way of thinking leads me to believe that that is basically what's going on here. But that's a sort of, I think that's a sort of trivial sort of teenage comment we most often grow out of, right? Because fine, that might be true in the context of physics. It doesn't mean there aren't all sorts of other concepts and ideas and types of entities layered onto that that have come into existence that can have their own intrinsic meaning. And I completely agree with you that I think sentience is the best way of finding a grounding in that. It's not a grounding in fundamental physics, but it's a grounding in the sense that as a sentient being, I think I'm basically an evolved animal. And other sentientists will disagree with this, by the way. They'll have different views of what sentience is. But in my view, sentience is an evolved class of information processing that I and you happen to be running, right? So there's nothing magical or distinct or separate about that. But it is deeply morally salient because of the way we define ethics, right? Because I can suffer, I can flourish, I have interests and I have needs because of this class of information processing that's running. And other people caring about that is just what we mean by morality. So that feels like a solid grounding. But at the same time, I might have some, it'd be interesting to explore your PhD students' views if we have more time, but I might have some affinity with their view because I guess I ground my moral consideration based on sentience. And I see what nature does to sentient beings. That does lead me to quite a cynical view about nature. I think nature is ultimately brutally amoral. You know, I don't think nature cares about the sentient beings that live within it. And probably the vast majority of the sentient beings within it, you know, go through enormous, terrible suffering. And that includes all of the, you know, many of the free-ranging animals too. I'm sure there's all sorts of great experiences and warmth and positivity and family connections, but there's also a lot of predation and starvation and disease and all sorts of other stuff as well. I'm nervous about positively attributing stuff to nature because I think it's just amoral. I think there's lots of wonderful, amazing things about it, and I think it just does exist. I don't think it's a good moral guide, and I don't feel any reverence for it because I do maybe, I don't know if this is what your PhD student's going, see it's pretty brutal when it comes to the experience of sentient beings.
I think her concern is largely around what you've mentioned, you know, the experience of wild animals, and therefore if that experience is existing, then what are the obligations on humans where they can to try and change that experience? So it's an interesting conversation.
Yeah, it is. And it's a fascinating space. I've had some quite deep conversations about that topic with Aditya from Animal Ethics and with Carl Johansson, who's written a book on wild animal ethics as well. And I wouldn't drag you into it here because it's massively complex. We're deeply uncertain about human intervention and how and whether to intervene. We're rightly concerned about human hubris, and you know, typically things don't go well when we intervene with nature, which we're doing all the time.
Yeah.
So it's a massively complex topic where we need a lot more research. For me, the starting point is, however complex that topic is, that's no reason to withdraw our compassion from sentient beings in the wild and free ranging. So just as my neighbors in this neighborhood here, hardly any of them are vegan, but they will all gush over the ducklings that trot around the local pond, or if there's an injured animal, they will call rescue and go and help, right? I'm completely with you, right? Free-ranging animals warrant our moral consideration. What to do with that is a breathtaking, complex question, but let's at least not withdraw our compassion from
it. Oh, no, absolutely not. No, certainly not.
So it would be interesting to come on to, so you have a broadly ecocentric view, but you see a distinctive role for sentience. And in your paper, it felt to me, the one I mentioned earlier on, sentience and intrinsic worth, it felt like your linking was something like sentience to intrinsic worth, to dignity, to rights, as a sort of flow of how you wanted to tell the story. Because once we've set a moral scope and said, look, at least all sentient beings warrant moral consideration, you've got still a dizzying variety of paths you can choose about, okay, what do we do about that next? And there are all sorts of different ethical systems you could apply, feminist care ethic, a virtue ethic, a deontological ethic, a utilitarian ethic, consequentialist ethics, and something else. And you could take a bunch of different approaches practically about how can we protect or help or reduce harm and exploitation of those sentient beings. So as we go from thinking about who matters to, I guess, this final big question about how can we make a better world, what do you think are the most productive ways that we could shift humanity to a state where we are putting empathy and compassion for all sentient beings actually into practice in a way that would actually make things better? And again, you can go wherever you like here, whether it's the role of law, whether it's the role of rights, whether it's the role of academia in education, whether you have a big picture view of a sort of utopia we can aim for. You know, how do you think we can make a better future for all sentient beings and shift humanity's role within that?
I mean, I suppose I tend to answer and address the question from the perspective of the law, because obviously I'm legally trained, and that's, you know, when you try to speak outside your lane, so to speak, sometimes you put your foot in it. So I try not to do that because sometimes it doesn't go well. I guess, you know, looking at the issues that confront humanity today, broadly under the umbrella of the Anthropocene, so many of them have deep roots in the dysfunctional relationships that humans have with animals. I've explored some of those in some of my research. So, for example, you know, zoonotic disease transmission, there's a clear linkage there between the increasing closeness with which we live with other animals and the, you know, incidence and experience of zoonotic disease transmission. Climate change, you make equally compelling case for the importance of industrial animal agriculture as a contributor to climate change. And so, and you know, we could go through another biodiversity loss and we could go through probably all of them and make a very strong, clear link. So I guess, you know, my conclusion from that is that those are symptomatic of a dysfunctional relationship with animals, other animals. And so what we want to do is we want to lead, so therefore leading to my conclusion that the legal system that we have that governs animals and the way in which we relate to animals is insufficient. That being predominantly the welfare system, animal welfare system. And then, you know, from my kind of background is, as I said, human rights. And there's a lot of discourse there around, you know, for example, rights of children and why are rights better than welfare protections? And you can have all those same arguments in the context of children or, you know, even before that, we would have had the same discussions in the context of women and so forth. In legal terms, rights are just stronger than welfare protections. They just are. And I think to the extent that you continue to have rights for human beings and welfare protections for other animals, you have immediately got an anthropocentric paradigm. You know, you've privileged humans as being more important than, and I don't think you're going to get a situation where you can rescue those relationships with animals within that paradigm. I don't necessarily think rights are a perfect paradigm either. There's a lot of criticism of rights as a framework, as a legal framework, and a lot that it doesn't capture relationships and so forth, ecosystems. But I think fundamentally granting animals rights at least puts them in the door to be able to claim protection or for other, for humans to claim protection on their behalf on some form of equal footing with humans. So I think animals need rights, legal rights. There's a bit of debate in the literature about whether that depends on animals being granted legal personhood or whether legal personhood is really just an incident of having rights. I think it's kind of technical lawyerish stuff. If we want it to happen, we can make it happen. In some jurisdictions, that is happening very slowly and not in my jurisdiction. I think the focus in that respect needs to be, you know, there's a lot of discussion around what rights, and often people lead off with wanting to talk about the right to life, which, you know, is wonderful, but I think it's actually one of the trickiest rights to talk about in the context of animals because, you know, we talked about nature and the circle of life and, you know, even just a basic understanding of the Lion King is, you know, that some animals eat other animals, right? I would probably prefer to start with the right not to be subject to torture, and I think that would cut out 90-95% of the issues that we have between humans and animals today. So, yeah, and I would start, I guess, from the with the issue of industrial agriculture because that is the one that affects by far and away the largest number of sentient animals and ties in most closely, I think, with a number of those issues that impact on humans. So, you know, it comes back to anthropocentrism in that respect as well, but that's not necessarily my main motivator.
Yeah, thank you. I'm an amateur in this field, but I do find the dynamic fascinating because when you think writ large about the non-human animal space and, you know, are we making progress? In some areas, it can feel like we really are making progress. And I think some of that is genuine. And you might feel that culturally in terms of the prevalence of veganism or the amount of public discourse that is engaging with these topics much more seriously. You can see that in shifts of academia in places like animal law and animal studies becoming more and more mainstream and more integrated and just harder to ignore in academia and philosophy. And you can also see that to some degree in law because when you look at, you know, the EU, for example, talking about recognizing animal sentience, and you can see other countries around the world, you know, taking similar approaches, recognizing non-human animals as sentient, and also recognizing that it is a morally salient characteristic, and therefore, you know, that feels like progress. But at the same time, the scale of industrial animal culture, aquatic and land-based, just continues to grow. And in that sense, if we're genuinely thinking about the perspective of these other beings, things are not getting better at all. It's getting worse and worse and worse. So, I mean, in your paper, I think one of the things you said in the abstract was, you know, welfare protections have failed animals. And I share a lot of that sense, because I find myself emotionally going through this slight roller coaster. You see this piece of legislation being announced, or recently in the UK, some research was done that impacted legislation on, look, decapods and some other types of crustaceans, yeah, are likely to be sentient, therefore we need to protect them in law, blah, blah, blah. And it's like, that's great. You can see the science, it's a naturalistic approach, recognizing sentience being done through research, goes into the law. And the conclusion is, let's just find slightly less torturous ways of killing and exploiting them. And I'm like, what? How did we go from there to there? Right? And in a way, that is the sort of central challenge to the welfare approach, is that it's just a way back into anthropocentrism. You know, we find another way of humane washing and making ourselves feel good, but actually we do nothing differently really for the victims. And the people who are more enthusiastic about the welfare approach might ask us to just be more patient. Right? This is, it's a step on the way, because as we move into, you know, welfare legislation, that will, one, make these industrial operations less economically productive, which will make it harder for them to continue. But also, because we've won these welfare, you know, milestones in the legal space and in the public discourse, we've won a recognition that sentience matters and that we should do something about it. Then we can build on that to work towards ultimately an abolitionist end of trying to end the exploitation, harm and suffering and killing of these non-human sentient beings. So they might say, look, you know, we're on journey, we're trying to get to the same place as you are, you know, give us more time and help. What's your response to that? Do you think it's this leeway in that, or do you think there's a risk that it is just a humane washing dead end? We need this approach that's more assertively rights-based.
It's a question that you can't answer one way or the other for sure, right? I mean, I have very strong views on it, but somebody else might have very strong views that are different from mine, and I can't prove that I'm right and they're wrong. I have a colleague in particular who I know feels quite sure that the welfarist approach can work, that, you know, we can achieve these goals still using the property categorization for animals. I don't agree. I think, on the other hand, I'm not abolitionist in the sense of I don't think that all kind of single issue campaigning is wrong or you know, is only inadvertently strengthening the welfare system. I don't think that's true at all. I've done some, you know, welfarist research in the past myself. So, for example, I published articles on calf roping as being a particularly bad practice that should come to an end. Doesn't mean that I support everything else that's not calf roping, right? It just means I think calf roping is really abhorrent.
So in that sense, you can do both, right? You can try and push on both directions at the same time.
Yeah, I think you can do both. The risk that you run, which is well pointed out to me, is that, you know, the more you try and make the welfare system better, the more welfare people will say, well, see, it's working, so we don't need something else.
You get complacent.
It will never properly work. It will never properly work because fundamentally, I guess it comes down to a view of human nature. Fundamentally, I don't think there will ever be a time when humans can put their own self-interest as equal to the animal's interest. I think people will always prioritize their own interests, and in particular, within a capitalist system, always prioritize their economic interests over the interests of animals, unfortunately, other animals. And you can only come up against that when the animals themselves, or people that are willing to speak, you know, who don't have that conflict of interest, are willing to speak on their behalf and have those interests recognized at law. And that the only way you can do that is through rights.
Thank you. Now, and you mentioned the right to life or the right not to be killed. And I find that a fascinating one, because when I read your paper, your concluding focus is quite strongly on rights not to be tortured, or rights not to be, you know, caused to suffer or to feel pain. And you didn't mention the right to life or the right not to be killed there. What risk is there that even that rights approach could fall into a similar trap that we've been talking about? So I guess the conversation I had most recently where we zeroed in on this was with Peter Singer. It's a fascinating conversation in a sense, because the title of his book is Animal Liberation Now, right? And was animal liberation, yeah. Right? So it's quite an extreme clarion call, right? Liberation, right? Not just be a bit nicer to them before you kill them, liberation. And I think his horror at industrial animal agriculture is absolutely genuine. And I think he would ultimately like to see all of it ended. I think he says he's against exploitation, not just, you know, suffering, but against exploitation, which again leads you to a more cleanly, you know, sort of abolitionist end. And he also pushed back on some of the interpretations of his utilitarianism around seeing non-human animals as just sort of containers of sentience that can be replaced. He's like, he actually said, the utility isn't some sort of abstract quantity that's floating free in the universe for us to maximize. It only makes sense in the context of individual sentient beings, because we were talking about this danger of having an ethical stance that, you know, makes you impersonal and detached so that you can genuinely consider many more beings. But there's a risk you've then emotionally detached from the individuals that were, I said, that was all part of the conversation. So in a sense, there's a lot I like in his, you know, philosophy and his stance, and his impact has been enormous. But at the same time, when you actually dig into his philosophy, he's not sure that killing itself is an ethical wrong. And that opens a door to him, at least in the thought experiment space, to, you know, the idea of humane killing. And by humane killing, this isn't just, you know, compassionate euthanasia in the best interests of the being that's being killed. It's humane killing because I want to sell your flesh to someone for them to eat, right? And so there's at least in his mind a sort of open, you know, he struggles to find a strong philosophical rejection of why that would be a harm, because he doesn't necessarily see killing by itself in isolation, if done without suffering and without causing the suffering of family and friends or whatever, as intrinsically bad. And that again opens the door to this idea of conscientious omnivorism, where, you know, you can bring non-human animals into being, you can give them a short, happy life, they have one bad day and we can carry on as we are. So in that sense, people will criticize him for being a welfarist and for his utilitarianism to have undermined one of the most important things to sentient beings, which is, because of the way we've evolved, we really want to keep living. We don't just want not to suffer. We want to keep living. Our families want to keep living. So is there a danger that in your framing of rights, if you don't include something about the right not to be killed, that we could end up in a similar sort of welfarist trap where we're, you know, doing the logic of the larder and they just have one bad day, but they don't have a right not to be killed. And as long as we didn't cause them to suffer through their lives, what's the problem?
Yeah, look, I should preface what I'm going to say with, I haven't worked out my comprehensive rights framework as yet. So when I
work say- Work in progress.
Absolutely work in progress. When I say the right to life is tricky, it doesn't mean that I don't think that it exists. I'm not saying that animals shouldn't have a right to life. But even when we talk about a right to life for humans, what we're talking about is a right not to be arbitrarily deprived of life. So that's quite a different thing. And I think, you know, when people throw around the terminology of right to life for animals, that becomes quite a different thing from even what we recognize humans have. So humans don't have the kind of rights that people seem to kind of throw around in the context of animal rights discussions. I think it's really hard to say people have a right to life, because there's so many things that can take away somebody's life. And if I have a right to an indefinite life, what obligations does that impose on, let's say, for example, state authorities to do everything in their power so that I can continue living? Do they have to provide me with free healthcare? Do they have to ensure, you know, OH&S? Do they have to ensure that, you know, there's no obstacles on the road that I'm walking on? Do they have to maybe ban cars because, you know, there's so many car accidents that kill people? So I think the obligations that would attach to that are kind of endless.
Rights are, and I guess that's one of the criticisms of rights in general, is they can be quite a sort of, they can be a, quite a blunt tool because they're supposed to be inviolable. But then if you take that seriously, you know, you end up in some pretty weird places. And of course, rights often conflict, so they can't be inviolable.
I had a professor at University of Melbourne who explained rights really well to me as, you know, the utility being in a kind of a framework that allows you to identify what matters and allows you or gives you the means by which to figure out what to do in the case of conflict. And that was really helpful to me. And I guess, you know, in the context of animals, do they have a right not to be arbitrarily deprived of life? I mean, again, I haven't done work, but my inclination would be to say yes. You know, should I be allowed to walk along the street and find a dog I don't like and then machete it to death? No, I shouldn't. But already the laws don't permit me to do that. They just don't frame it as a right, and they probably don't have, you know, institutionalized enforcement and such to ensure that, you know, that I'm punished for doing something I should have done. I guess my point is just, I think there's so much more strength to a discussion around a right not to be tortured because everyone agrees on that. And it's kind of obvious what that would mean in the context of industrial agriculture. We just shouldn't be doing the things we're doing. It's kind of like when you said earlier that, you know, empathy and morality is kind of like they just fit together, right? Like you're talking about rights, but nobody should torture me, right? Like, that's kind of a no-brainer, yeah? Well, at least to me it is. So that would be my starting point, but it doesn't mean it's the end of the inquiry. And you know, there's some interesting stuff out there as well, I think from Alistair Cochrane, especially around, you know, do animals have the right to liberty, yeah, and these other kinds of issues as well that are equally interesting.
Yeah, absolutely. I think you're right about this. You know, almost everybody agrees that non-human animals shouldn't be tortured and that's the wrong thing. But most people don't think that's what is happening in animal agriculture, right? And that's either through deliberate avoidance or deliberate ignorance, or it's through, you know, warping their own epistemology to believe that these non-human animals live long, happy lives in fields and then are quietly euthanized in their sleep with no pain and no trauma to their family, right? There's something going on in people's minds that makes them assume that that must be what's happening. And again, that's partly the worry about not having that focus on, you know, arbitrary killing, is that if you don't cover the killing thing and people kid themselves that the killing is done without suffering, again, we're in a difficult place. But that was helpful, that sort of clarification between the difference between the right to life and the right not to be arbitrarily deprived of life, I think is a really powerful one. Yeah, thank you. And how do you think we should best progress on this front? So we already have this, you know, institutions built around human rights. We have the Declaration that obviously many people would probably rewrite now if they had the chance. But at least, like you said, it's that stake in the sand and an aspiration, and one that we're every day failing to achieve. But I agree with you that I'd rather we had that than we didn't, right? It still felt like an important stake in the ground. In the rights space, there seem to be a bunch of different approaches we could take. So one is, let's now do something separate that is focused on non-human animal rights. And some of those exercises frankly get turned off into a welfarist path. But we can either have distinct non-human animal rights, or I did a slightly weird thought experiment, which is actually rewriting the Universal Declaration of Human Rights as a Universal Declaration of Sentient Rights and say, look, here's another path. Instead of having two separate views, why don't we put it all into one and say, look, every sentient being warrants rights? And it was an interesting thought experiment because it was easier than I thought it was going to be, because I assumed that there were going to be loads of different rights that just weren't relevant to non-human animals. And even some of those, like a right to education, I thought, you could actually apply that to non-human animals, right? You can apply that to the way that non-human animal families should have the right to teach their offspring or, you know, bring them up, right? So even in some of the ones where I thought this just isn't going to be relevant to non-humans, it was like, maybe it could be. But the second conclusion I came to was that actually for the most fundamental, most important rights, the ones we'd all say, that's, you know, these are in my top 10, which were really, you know, about not suffering and not being killed and right to sustenance and shelter and, you know, the most fundamental rights are the ones that were most obviously common across all sentient beings, ultimately because we share a common evolutionary history. So what's, if you get want to get a little bit more utopian, how do you think we could take a rights approach, the sort that you're working on, and push that forward? Should there be something separate for non-human animals that's distinct? Could we find an integrated way of upgrading human rights to extend to sentient rights, or something else? How do you think that might play out?
In my kind of ideal world where animal rights is accepted, I just had a big conversation about this exact topic in a reading group just a week ago. So it's an interesting question. I would kind of agree with you that in theoretical terms, I would see it as kind of an umbrella category of sentient rights. And then you would have, I mean, in practical terms, at the way in which laws have developed to date as anthropocentric, at the most, I guess, the easiest and not just the easiest, but probably the most, the best and most understandable way to do it at this point would be to have human rights because they're already in existence, and then as a parallel, develop non-human rights. There are plenty of people that say, there's certainly a strong stream in the scholarship that advocates animal rights as a, for example, a subset of sentient rights, or a subset of human rights, so an extension of human rights to animals. So there's kind of technical questions about how best to do it. I think in kind of the practical terms that where we've come from and where we are, it makes sense to say there are sentient rights. Here are the human rights we've already established, and here are the non-human animal rights. But that said, that poses issues, obviously, straight away in terms of, well, humans are more similar to some non-human animals than to many other kinds of non-human animals. So why are we distinguishing between humans and primates, and they're somehow different from, decapod crustaceans and blah, blah, blah. I mean, I guess from an idealistic kind of theoretical perspective, it would make more sense just to say sentient rights, and then whatever right you were talking about, is it relevant for this individual or not relevant for this? Because some human rights are not relevant for children, right, or not relevant for people suffering extreme mental disabilities, for example. So, just because the rights are there doesn't mean they're actually relevant for you at all times. So even though you could say there's a sentient right to vote, well, okay, but it doesn't apply to dogs because they don't understand that.
It's got to tie back to the relevant interests of the individual in there, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, they have to be able to, I don't want to make the connection to agency because I don't believe in that, but there has to be some aspect by which that can be relevant to their lives. And I guess we can sign a proxy for all the non-human animals to vote on their behalf, but it really wouldn't be workable. But I think you're right. I think there are a lot of rights in, what we consider today to be human rights that would actually translate to non-human animals in ways that perhaps people don't really think about. One thing, for example, I think about is the right to family and not to have family life interrupted. I think, particularly in the context of industrial agriculture, that there's something that really gives pause for thought. So, yeah, look, I don't know if I've answered your question. I guess there's a practical way, and there's a theoretically ideal way, and probably the practical ways I tend to be more practically oriented.
Thank you. Yeah, no, that's great. How optimistic do you feel about whether we'll be able to make this sort of shift, and how quickly? And do you think the breakthrough is more likely to come through at sort of national or regional levels, or a new declaration at the UN that comes through the UNCHP work or something else, or is it just like pull on all levers at once? And do you think we could viably make this shift, and we could get towards a more utopian world where maybe there is a universal declaration of sentient rights, and not only that, but it is actually has some degree of enforcement in law that really drives a serious change?
I guess in general, I tend to be probably a more positive person. But I guess in relation to that question, I still struggle to, I'm probably still cynical. We've had many decades where people have talked about animals and caring for animals and animal welfare and so forth. And I think the problem has only gotten worse rather than better. We see the way in which humans relate to the environment and the lack of response we have to the urgency of climate change. the positive side of me says, well, let's push animal welfare and let's alongside that push the urgency of the climate crisis and tie it back to animals and push the zoonotics issue and tie that back to animals. And maybe with enough leverage there, we'll convince some people, probably more at the UN level because, you know, they tend not to be so economically impacted. There might be some traction. And I guess, you know, we do see some of that. You know, there will be a pandemic treaty. There is rights for animals recognized in some jurisdictions to some degree. But I guess the cynical part of me thinks I think time will run out, probably. Hope to be proved wrong.
Well, I'm glad you're working to prove yourself wrong. So, yeah. Well, thank you. That's been fascinating. And I sort of share that sense. It feels like the potential is there, right? Because nearly all humans already care about some non-human animals. I mean, who would want to needlessly harm and kill non-human animals, right? So that sort of latent ethic is in nearly everybody's brain. But, the social norms and the psychology and the vested interests and so on are pretty powerful. It makes this a very frustrating species when we're trying to drive positive change. So, I retain some hope there. But
yeah, there's hope. There's certainly hope. There's a really neat quote that one of my colleagues in Switzerland had run past me recently. I don't have it up on the screen, but it's something really nice about, in the context of accusing, the kind of legal provisions I talk about as being welfare washing, that even if they are kind of welfare washing, sometimes when you fake it long enough, eventually it becomes real. And I guess that's kind of my approach here. If we just keep saying that this is a real thing, it might turn into one.
Yeah, I like it. Believe the hype for long enough, and maybe we'll get there. Well, maybe that's a positive note to wrap up on. Well, thank you so much. It's been brilliant to talk to you and hear about your philosophical journey and how your work fits into that now. More power to you. Is there anything else you want to add into the conversation or?
No, I think that's a really interesting conversation. Thank you for inviting me.
It was such a pleasure. I think we've answered what's real, what matters, who matters, and how to make a better future in 90 minutes. That's a pretty good game. So we just need to persuade the other 8 billion humans now and we'll be fine.
That's simple.
Maybe also the powerful AI as well. They're a new constituency we need to consider.
Yes.
We need to persuade them to be sentient too, otherwise we're in trouble.
Yes, indeed.
Well, it's been such a pleasure. Thank you. What's the best way of people following you? I don't know how much whether you do much social media or read your papers or...
Yeah, look, I don't do a lot of social media. Actually.
It's probably wise.
All the research says don't do it, so I tend not to. But then the research networks go and use Facebook, right? So probably the most up-to-date is my actual institutional profile, so Deakin, Jane Kotzman, and reading the papers. Sometimes I do a bit of media, but that's about it.
No, that sounds good. Nice and simple. I'll include links to the talk you did for the Cambridge organisation.
Cambridge Centre for Animal Rights Law, yeah.
Thank you. Yes, I'll include a link to that in your paper too, so.
People can, of course, email me. There is still that function.
That still exists.
Yes. So please feel free to leave the email, I swear. But thank you for inviting me. It has been lovely.
It's been a real pleasure. I'll let you get on with your evening.
Thanks so much, Jane.
Take care. Bye.
Thanks for listening. You're helping to normalise rational, compassionate thinking. Don't forget to subscribe, leave us some stars or a review. You can visit sentientism.info to find out more, and you'd be very welcome in any of our online community groups. The biggest is on Facebook. If you like what we're doing, why not tell your friends about us?